Let's go ahead and start. Maybe we should move in closer if that's all it shows up. So I want to call this meeting to order. So Stephanie, would you do a roll call, please?
Susan Fowler.
Here.
Tom Moore.
Here.
Joe Omo Asagye. Elaine Plincia. Kyle Patterson. Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Jane Sprandel. Margaret White.
Here. I don't think there's any.
Well, we don't need to make any decisions because it's a study session.
So we can't approve the agenda then, right? Okay. All right.
You can talk.
We can talk.
We can have a study
session. So my only, it's a study session. Oh, good. My only comment is I really appreciated the article on Walmart having behavioral health services. I mean, if you're going to have LCSWs, so hi there, Joe. That was this. I just think it's thinking outside the box, and people go in there, they don't have to say, oh, I'm going to see my therapist. It's like, oh, I'm just going to Walmart. And apparently, I would love to see the data on it. It's one store now in Texas. Is that?
Well, the context was, I don't know if this was in the article or if it was in the comments later, but Dr. Manderscheid, who's the director of our National Association, had this conversation with an administrator in West Virginia 10 years ago that Walmart has the infrastructure that you need. And, you know, it's at first I thought, oh, this is so silly. And then I was like, no, that's great. That's exactly where they should be. Anyway.
I thought they have the primary care physicians there. So they have the physicians there. They have the pharmacy. I know, I thought it's thinking outside the box, and people wouldn't be afraid to go there.
It's
so.
Actually thinking inside the box.
The big box. That's very good. So those were my only comments tonight. So I guess I'd like to see how you guys would like to proceed on this, to do discussion of our current priorities. And do you want to start with that? Start talking about it, and then we're going to go ahead.
Now we have a quorum.
Oh, do you want to approve the? Let's go ahead. Right. Thank you for saying that. I've had about 2 days in the car, so I'm like zombied out. With my 90-year-old mother, which was so much fun, but my brain is gone. May I have? Let's see, what page is the agenda on?
This is it.
Oh, I need. Do I have a second? Okay, second. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. All right, thank you. Okay, so Lynn, I'm going to have you start with comments about our current priorities. And then.
Well, I don't know if this is the right way to do it. You might have preferred to just jump into a conversation about all the priorities, but we just thought to give you some background, if you want to do it this way, just take these one priority at a time. So there are four. So at the end of October, you'll do the other two, unless you want to do them all today. The other two are system of care and the developmental disabilities programs. So actually, by the end of October, the DD board might have a near final draft of their priorities, which we would include for you. So today's priorities are behavioral health for people with justice involvement and innovations and access to care. And so we've got, we tried to provide, he found the history, which was so helpful, just a history of each one of these priority areas. And I think then just completely by coincidence yesterday, I got this, you know, the federal recommendations document, which it doesn't say anything that you haven't been talking about already, but that was kind of nice. So anyway, like if we have any thoughts about that our justice involvement work is like way off track, we don't have to worry about that. But these are both fairly old priorities. And the value of retaining them over these years is, you know, partly like you can make a chart and compare your investments across the years for what it's worth. So Mark made a chart, and that's the last page. So you can, and it'll be the, we'll provide that chart again at the next study session. But, you know, other than that, I don't know if these priorities continue to serve our community well. I think, you know, as far as like this responding to changes in the state system or state funding, not much has changed. Some, you know, new versions of the chaos, but it doesn't really leave us as a local entity with like a completely different landscape to react to. And then in the federal priorities are, you know, they have kind of shifted a little bit, but also not. I think the biggest shift has been a lot of attention to opioid addiction, and the truth is in Champaign County, that is not the number one addiction and overdose problem. It's really not. We have methadone and synthetics, and I mean but it's really not just opioids. You know, it's alcoholism is actually still a problem in this community. So I don't know that you need to really embrace that, which is a very new, that's a newer, it's kind of shiny federal priority, but addiction care for sure. So anyway, I'm not convinced.
It's only us, right? Oh, it has to be recorded. The chart that somebody out there?
Page 9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the last page. I was just trying to understand it. There's the shift from 18 to 19 of $1 million from the justice and mental health category. What is just operationally? What is it that's going on there?
So some of what's going on there is how the the awards were classified in 2000, and then you also have some changes related to PLL. But the one of the driving factors there between the shift between 18 and 19 is that it was an internal process in terms of assigning which program to which priority. And then in 19, we used what agencies actually selected, that they were asked to actually select the priority under which they were applying.
Oh, I now see that a similar amount is increased in the system of care category. So I'm assuming it means that programs got reclassified, which
yes.
is what you're saying.
Yes.
This is not an actual
change
in what we're doing. It's a change in the way we've classified the program.
If you look at the bottom, the totals show you, you know, the growth in the total amount allocated over the 3 years. So that gives you some sense of the additional investment that's been made out in the community. And part of that increased funding is a result of natural growth within the levy, but also through decisions that were made internally by Lynn and
But I think that's really right. Like the impact of moving programs from one priority to another is pretty big here. You know, like none of these pockets of money are big enough to hide that impact.
So just to comment.
But it's artificial.
It is artificial.
Yeah. And so it's artificial, but it also indicates to me that maybe organizing my thinking by what these categories are doesn't make a lot of sense. Because it's artificial.
Yeah, I like that. So working on the details with them.
It's better to think about, you know, what programs we support and which ones we don't like and which ones we do like and which ones we'd like to see that don't have. But if we get caught into which place they're classified as, it might be an illusion. So anyway, just a thought.
There's maybe one program, and I want to apologize. I said methadone a second ago. I did not mean that. I meant crystal meth, so sorry. Or methamphetamine. So maybe Mark can is this right that one program really did step back from justice involvement? That's the Promise Healthcare, the Promise Wellness and Justice. They moved away from justice involvement
That's one example. They're now just the wellness program. They weren't having much engagement through the justice system, so they chose just to be wellness. Another example within the justice and mental health category is the shift in support and in funding support for Parenting with Love and Limits. So that that program had a significant reduction from 2018 to 2019 because the program consolidated, and instead of being a $600,000+ program or $600,000 program, it was under $400,000. So there's $200,000. We also had a few or some of the victim services programs, victims of crime, domestic violence, or sexual violence. Some of those programs, I think, also chose to apply as part of the system of care as opposed to justice and mental health. And then there were also some new initiatives, I think, that were funded. So.
I just want to comment in terms of, I think it's really good to revisit priorities and maybe think on the macro level, and the questions on page 8 are kind of global questions. What I don't really think we should do, this is my opinion, in April, we spent hours going through each of the programs and talking about them in detail. So it kind of gave my stomach a lurch to see a short discussion of each program and to think that we might actually evaluate the programs based on this very short paragraph, because that's what we did just less than four or five months ago. So I think it makes sense to say, do the priorities in general remain relevant? Are there things that we're missing? Is there something that we should be doing that we're not doing? And, you know, hopefully the agencies would also tell us that, because otherwise we're a closed community. And then I would expect you and Mark and others on the from the office to tell us if the operating environment is going to change, because I really don't have a sense of that. So I would just caution us not to go through and say, well, do we really want to keep Rattle the Stars or Family Services? And I was looking to see if there was overlap between some services and another, and then I thought, wait a minute. We spent many, many hours on that in April, March, April, and May. So I don't want to get into the details of each of these programs, my perspective, maybe the rest of you do, but I do want to go back to some of the questions that I think Julian and Tom raised at the end of our discussion in May or June, and that is, we still approve what was mainly requested and submitted. We approve 90% of what's submitted. What we have now is a better ability to understand what's being funded than we might have had a few years ago, because we've studied it, we've broken into, you know, groups to read specific proposals, but does it make a difference? And so going back to the how can we best use our time, and I don't have an answer to this, but I think I've thought a lot about, I put so much effort into the review process, and I think it really helped me understand what it is that we're funding. But I also agree with Julian and Tom when they raised the critique of, well, all those hours we spent didn't make a difference. It's a lot of work. And I'm not saying that the work's not appropriate, but are we seeing the gestalt of what's needed in our community? Are we asking the right questions? Because right now what we are doing is we are responding positively to the agencies. And, you know, we are in a few cases saying, no, we didn't like that. That wasn't really an appropriate request. But out of 40 requests, we usually fund 38 or something like that. So I'd kind of like to go back to that discussion. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephanie. Add something to the discussion about the chart, in that if we look at that chart now, it looks like this is what we're doing. And so we can easily say that this is artificial, but I'm guessing that if Mark had gone back further, that at least what you get is a sense of how this board has changed and how it has began supporting the behavioral health for those people involved with it. Because at one point, I think I had this conversation with Mark, and it is, what we're doing now is way more than what we were doing, I don't know, maybe 6-7 years ago. And when this first got introduced to us, this was not something that this board did, this being involved with the criminal justice system. So we've made a tremendous step, good or bad. I have, yes, I do have a thought about it. Good or bad, but we have made a tremendous jump. So this just gives us a snapshot of today where we are. Even though it might be artificial, it doesn't say how this board has evolved to get to where it is today. That was a long, hard process.
No, thank you. I definitely know. When we started paying at least formal attention, we were doing some things that we just didn't call that criminal justice, but we definitely started to pay attention to it, as I think it says in here, at the time when it became a community issue. And we brought it up here and talked about what's our responsibility with regard to the issues the community was raising about mental health and the criminal justice system. I also have the impression, and this started before I joined the board, although it continued for the first couple of years that I was here, the Access Initiative, I think, may have created some, like, the system of care category. Mm-hmm. So that's also a change. And so those are two big ways, I think, mm-hmm. that the board has changed at least how it's thinking about what it's doing, both as in terms of system of care and in work with mental illness and the criminal justice system. Whereas I think if you went back some number of years, we would not have found that as a set of conceptions about the kinds of things that we're doing. I believe that's correct. If it's wrong, somebody tell me.
Well, I think about how we've expanded services in the summer and in the school year to support children and youth in being successful mm-hmm. academically, socially, behaviorally, that we assumed maybe earlier were the school's responsibilities. So think of Dream House and Neighborhood Connections and the Don Moyers. It's all part of the system of care. You know, those I think were really important expansions. And I don't know what would happen in the community if suddenly those supports went away. I mean, it would be, I think, really traumatic. I think we also, by putting money behind some of those supports, I'm suspecting that other agencies put money in too, so that it's not just supported through the mental health board, but the school districts and other organizations made it a priority as well. And I guess that's one way to look at our impact. To what extent did our seeding, S-E-E-D-I-N-G, some of these support programs help leverage expansions in the community?
Well, if I may say so, in light of that comment, I don't know if anybody noticed, but not too long ago, in public remarks from Champaign with respect to the community coalition and so on. The I think it was the mayor who said she was proud to acknowledge that Tracy Parsons was an employee who was making a lot of this great stuff happen. So if anybody from the county, there's at least one county board member listening, if anybody from the county board listens to this conversation, I think the county should notice that this was something that they didn't want to have. And they fought hard to not have it. And they made a mistake. But fortunately, some of the other government units picked it up. And together, we're able to both maintain our system of care. And maybe it's great that Tracy is now working for the city. I'm not opposed to that. It's just, that's also a way in which this board has had a big impact on the community. I would love to be able to also claim it as something that we've done well, rather than as something that we should apologize for, which at one time I think we were supposed to be apologizing for it. So I'm not apologizing.
I think if you look at the data page, how we have switched a priority in the system of care and increased prevention. And I think that it is important to acknowledge people like that article did on Tracy, but I think we can do that more effectively when we have data. And so just as our meeting last week, when you're looking at all of the program, it's hard to do data on services, but even the data of students reached in the summers and thinking of what their alternatives would be. And so that we make sure that we're out there and encouraging our agencies, this is great. We want to know how you're affecting attendance at school later. We want to know about kids' connections to schools or kids' connections in the community, or you know, if you're going to midnight basketball, you have a better chance of not being arrested, which is a data point for the midnight basketball. But I think for us to keep on encouraging our agencies in that way. The other thing I was thinking about is, and Susan said it earlier about these as priorities, and we have our agencies fill what we perceive as the need, but thinking about how are we asking them? I mean, their perspective and view would be differently since they're down, many of them down in the trenches. So that's one of my thoughts on all of our funding priorities. Tom?
I don't want to lose Susan's question about everything we do in the aggregate, what difference does it make to the community? I suspect that if we took everything away, you'd find out very, very quickly. On the other hand, if you follow it, you know, systematically, are we really making a big difference? Or is there a big difference in this community because of these programs? Not to lose that point for this evening.
If I could respond, one of the things that I think needs to continue as a priority is the evaluation component. Not that all projects need to be evaluated at the level that the U of I folks are doing, but to have that access and resource to understand that you can use a logic model to identify your resources, how your resources are being expended or utilized, and what the outcomes are from the outputs, the resources. And you know, it'll take years to really, for most of the agencies, to have a strong handle, but they're beginning to be able to say, we made a difference here, here, and here. And so while that may come out of the administrative dollars, I think it is a priority to continue to engage in evaluation, because it is one way to begin to see what difference does it make. And to, I think, present to other members of the community as the data become reliable, what the investment means. So if there's ever any threat to the levy or the mental health board's prerogatives or existence, that evaluation information, I think, will be really critical.
In so many of the agencies, they're a two-person staff, and they need the assistance in working on evaluation because they don't have the manpower, and so they need to see how to do it effectively. Any other comments on the evaluation component?
Well, I think I don't have a lot of expectation that all the service agencies are going to be doing what I would call good outcome research. I think that's a little bit much for people whose primary job is to deliver services and try to make their dollars go as far as they can and so on. But I do think it's not unreasonable to create, and this is where I think this matters, it's to create a kind of cultural expectation among the agencies that we should logically figure out what are our goals, and we should regularly, not in a haphazard way, but in a systematic way, address the question, are we moving toward our goals or not? And to create that.
And using our resources
to move
towards our goals.
That's so if we can continue to create that sort of, I think that's where we can make a culture of human service change in the county.
So are you saying that we, as a board or as a community, we ought to have a goal about what we are expecting from these agencies?
I do definitely think that.
Okay, yeah. Just wanted to be clear on that.
If I can just add to that, I remember a time when the agencies were asking, 1%, 2%, 10% of every individual on staff of their salary. It was really hard to see how that was going to contribute to certain outcomes or goals. And the proposals that have come in now are much more linked to staff who are doing specific work that relate to what was funded through the Mental Health Board. We're not just helping them maintain their budget, hopefully. I'm sure that is part of it, but hopefully it's more targeted and focused.
You know what, I wonder in terms of what impact are we having on this community. I wonder if we ask the question to, what do you call them, clients or those people receiving services. If you ask the question, what would you do if this program wasn't here? And we kind of, you get that, of course, it's just speculation because you don't know what you would do if it wasn't here. But just give a sense of what you might, how important that this program is to people who are being served and where they would be left in their mind if this program didn't exist.
So Susan was reminding me what she was saying of that conversation, which I kind of forgot that we had, which was about we spend all this time going in great detail through each of these programs, which to some extent we have to do to know what they are. But when you look at the result, there's not a lot of impact on how the money is allocated. So I sort of think maybe we have a choice about how we proceed in the future. I'm not sure which way is the best way, but one way to proceed is that you recognize that there are human service agencies out there concerned with mental health broadly, and they tell us what they want to do, and we look at it, and we try to support them. An alternative view is we look at the needs of the community and our understanding of mental health and other related social issues, and we say, these are the kinds of things we want to support. So tell us, can you do this? Can you help us achieve these ends? And those are two very different models for how we function. I mean, they could be more closely modeled in how we evaluate comes in. Like, you know, so if I think we're actually currently operating, despite these broad categories, on the agencies say what they want to do, and we try to support them, which isn't necessarily bad. We could be much more, we could more make more of an effort to solicit in given areas what we want them to do. I mean, we have obviously done some of this by doing the system of care. When we had, you know, that access initiative, we had a way of doing that. Mm-hmm. And we responded somewhat to the need for recognizing the shift in how many people who have mental health needs are in the criminal justice system, which is nationally an issue. So maybe there's, I guess I'm sort of thinking that what we have, it would be useful for us to think, do we have proactive goals or reactive
so
support goals?
Going back to kind of what I was posing, so do we as a board, they pose this to the agencies that are going to ask for different monies, saying, okay, rattle the stars. This is the question that would like you to answer. I don't know what the question would be, but Rosecrans. So posing specific questions so that they can, we can, saying that this is the community need for rattle the stars. We need an adolescent support group to meet on a weekly basis or bi-monthly basis to discuss these issues. So is Rattle the Stars that agency that will follow through and come up with that answer to that issue? Because apart from church groups, there are very few adolescent groups going on in the community. So is there a way to say, okay, if we're talking prevention, is there a possible, who is going to pursue a prevention group for adolescents?
I guess that I don't know if this is more of like a legal question of what we're capable of doing as far as soliciting, but typically grants, and I know these are technically contracts, but it's functions in many ways the same way. Typically grants are not open the way that ours is. A grant is, here's a description of what we need you to do, you apply to do it. What if we, you know, identified, you know, this is something that's missing in the community that we need, and we set the description instead of the opposite where people are telling us what they're going to do?
Request for proposal.
Yeah, if that's what that would be, even. I mean, is that something that's been explored before, or
we've talked about it as an option for addressing potential unmet needs that we recognize, but we've never done anything because we haven't established a system.
Mm-hmm. We did.
You did one?
The Scylla.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but say more about why. What about it, though?
So I don't think that it's ever been the practice to do RFPs. I'm not sure historically why, but there is a lot of specificity in the priorities document to sort of say, this is what we're looking for, and I think that could even be developed more. But you're right, like it's just kind of apply for what you want to do and we'll decide. But I want to respond to something because there are other possible reasons that you're saying yes to most of what's requested. One possibility is that the agencies are organizing themselves differently, like that you have asked for years and years for less competitive separate work and more collaborations, and there really are more collaborations. They're not necessarily perfect. They're not necessarily what you hoped for, but they may have resulted in agencies kind of picking a lane, you know, and not applying all to do the same things. I've seen a decrease in that in just the last couple of years, but I think that might be a small factor in why there are few, you know, there are very few requests that you don't say yes to. I think the bigger factor is that this workforce shortage is really kind of shocking. And I mean, we're in the middle of there's a very stable contract that you've funded for years and years and years and years, and they can't keep it staffed. And it's in the justice involvement area, and it's really taking a lot of attention lately, and it's drug court. So when something like that, which is a kind of a well-paying, nice context, lots of good public attention, can't keep stable staff, I think that's indicates the workforce shortage problem is fully here. So I think that's another reason that you're seeing a less competitive application process. But if you want to do more RFPs, we could certainly do that. The SILA RFP process was really hard. You have to have a committee, you have to publish a timeline, the specifications have to be really clear, and all they're doing is bidding. So you really have to know what the approach that you want for sure. And so that part with SILA was kind of easy, but then the time involved was not so easy, and there were not very many applicants, and of the applications, they were not perfect, and that was a reflection of that capacity problem, because that's been true in DD for a long time. And since then, I've started working with an attorney who has a lot of experience with doing RFPs in the county, maybe more than anybody else, and he says, don't do them. If you have to do them, he had some real practical advice, like you don't use the evaluation, the scoring tool. You just tape record the conversation that the evaluation committee has. So if you want to do a series of RFPs, we could absolutely explore that. It requires committees to get it done. But anyway.
Can I go? So Kyle and I both had our hands up, and Kyle went. So yeah, that's okay. So I just, a couple of thoughts I want to throw out. And I don't mean to create spinning wheels, but I once worked for the federal government overseeing $24 million annually in grant applications, and there were a lot of grant applications that came in response to RFPs and also field-initiated. There's a lot of work that goes into setting up an RFP. We'd have to really, or the staff would really have to know exactly what they wanted. It's not an easy way. There was a real consensus that field-initiated proposals really spoke from the field about what was needed. And we basically have what I would call field-initiated proposals, mm-hmm. the agencies propose. One of the things that we did a couple of years ago that I think made the proposals more collaborative or less overlapping and competing was we did put into the priorities a requirement that they included letters of support from, not that they had memorandums of agreement or they had interagency coordination. I'm not sure exactly how we put it, but they had to be able to say that they were working with multiple agencies and identify what those agencies were, so that we didn't have one group saying, well, this group shouldn't be funded because we do all the work. If there were, in fact, two groups, they were at least collaborating on what they were doing. That happened in the DD program at one point. I don't know that it happened in mental health, but it would be as though Rosecrans said, nobody else needs to provide mental health because we're the big agency in town. And obviously, that's not the way we funded things, and Rosecrans hasn't come in and said that either. So I think that if we see something that is missing that needs to be included, that's an opportunity for an RFP. But I would hate to change our whole system because it would be so much work to a request for proposal system. I think that, you know, for the most part, Rattle the Stars emerged 2 years ago because there there was a group in the community that said, we're really concerned about the suicide rate, and nobody's addressing it, and they came forward, and we agreed, and we funded them more the second year because they were had some success in the first year. GROW was a new effort a couple of years ago. So because our funding has allowed us to expand, we've been able to fund some new ideas that we might not have thought of that seem to be still relevant. And, you know, we've always said that if a program's not working, we'll take it to task. And in fact, we have done that and no longer fund a few things. So I guess what I'm saying is there's got to be, I think, a respect for the field or the agencies coming in with requests, and we provide feedback on whether or not we think those are meeting the needs of the community. Whether we do it as critically as we've done in the past, I think, is a question to ask. There also should be a little bit of room to say, you know, we don't really have anything that's addressing enough adolescent activities or supports, if we think that's the case, where we could say we'd like to hear more. So
there's language in the priorities memo and also in the funding guidelines that we're really careful to put those in for this, for exactly the reason that you mentioned. Like, there really is not a history of lots of RFPs, and there could be a need for it. So just like you said, if something's missing, we can do that. And I think, you know, we'll just do it and figure out how to do it.
But we don't want to go to a full-scale RFP.
But you could, I mean, if there's a gap right now, we could develop a process, and then we learn from that, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, we don't have to be all or none about it. We can have a mixed model. There's a lot to be said for supporting programs that have already emerged that are being done well, and I don't think anybody wants to stop doing that. But in order to have a mixed model, I think you're absolutely correct that there's no reason why we couldn't do an RFP or do use some other method to get some responsiveness to stimulate something that we see as necessity. But in order to do it, we need to tell ourselves and have that discussion. And if all of our time is taken up with the extensive ways in which we go over all the existing programs, many of which we know so well, we might not need to quite spend all of our time and energy that way, and instead have more sessions in which we discuss and look around and get the bigger picture and say, well, maybe what could we do to stimulate? And it doesn't have to be an RFP. It could be a different methodology. But
something on that. I think one of the things, when you say we know the program so well, I think the previous reviews have helped us to do that. So, I mean, that's why we know them now and what's really going on, to study them.
So I just want to add one thing to that, and then I'll shut up about it this moment anyway. but I don't want to leave it at that, because the one thing I wanted to add is that the reason we know so much about them is because we have members who have been on the board for a while. There's turnover. So what happens is, and this is how we ended up in the system that we developed, was there were a lot of new members who didn't feel comfortable because they didn't know enough about what was going on, and we needed a way to get everybody to know what was going on. Now that we got most members knowing what's going on, we might be able to shift back, but it'll always be changing. This is sort of my point, because at some point, there's turnover. It's built into the system, which isn't bad. It just means that sometimes the board's going to have to go through a more fine-tuned look, and sometimes it could step back and so on.
Yeah, just a real quick comment. You know, we have talked about funding some programs that are stable for multiple years. even if the budgets were to change from year to year without having to go through the intense review, you know, I think we're at a point where we can say we don't really need to have an intense review of some of these programs because, right, or, you know, I'm not even sure which ones to identify, but ones that we've been funding for a long time and we've been pleased with what's going on, we shouldn't have to go into deep review on an annual basis. There should be some kind of rotating review. I mean, I don't think that at this point we're planning on not funding Children's Advocacy Center or specialty courts, drug court, or first followers, or things like that. So we could give ourselves a little bit of a break and say that based on the history of funding and performance, unless there's some dip, which our office team would tell us because they look at the quarterly reports. I mean, Mark and Stephanie and Chandra are on top of these things. And they know more than we do because they're looking at the quarterly reports. So we were afraid to do two-year funding a couple of years ago because we didn't maybe have enough of a handle on how well we knew the programs. But I don't feel that way anymore. And I do think it's important that we open up some space so that we're not spending as much time on the review process or turning over 200 questions to the agencies.
That the RFP thing did come up in this group at one point, and it was when we were talking about how can we extend the time limit that we have on grants, and maybe that's a new idea we need, and we don't need to just throw it out there. We need to have a focus idea how to deal with a new idea, or maybe we're talking about new programs. So we did, this RFP thing did come up, but it felt like, as Lynn says, it's too overwhelming for a small agency to be able to manage it. I think I'm remembering that correctly. And the other thing about these field programs that kind of we think drive us, I'm not sure that's always correct. I think what happens is, because we wouldn't fund everything that someone comes and suggests, hey, let's do this. There's a good chance that we'll say no. And the reason is because we have an idea in our head what we think a mental health board should be doing. While it may look like they're driving the automobile, that's not completely true. They have a large impact. And because I remember that the system of care thing, and Peter did a large, before any of you were on the board, he did a large conference over a weekend and brought down speakers from Chicago. And that's when we instituted the system of care notion. The access was, it just fit perfectly in where we wanted to go. So there are times when we do direct what's happening here. And so the way I think we direct it is, we have a larger, broader concept in our head of what mental health services should be like. So if someone comes in and they want to do a dog walking program, we're probably going to say no. Most likely we'll say no. So we're not doing everything. We're not doing everything just because someone suggested.
I think there might be a good dog walking program that could be good for mental health.
Well, then we'd have to see it, right?
But, you know, I'm sorry, I'm talking again. If I can keep talking, I will. If I can't, tell me not to. The thing is, we don't have funds are not infinite. So if we're ever going to do anything new,
then you have to typically decide, well, where are you going to get the money from? And
well, what's missing? First, what's missing?
So, yeah, I mean, you have to do that kind of analysis. And also, well, what are we spending money on that we don't want to spend it on? Because all of this, it does imply shifting money around from existing things if you're going to do new things. Unless, remember, the Access Initiative brought in quite a bit of money from the federal government. So, therefore, it was easy. That was new money. You could do whatever you wanted because nobody was going to cry because you weren't taking money away from them. It's different once things are established. So you have to sort of contend with, plus the staff have to contend with all these professionals in the community who are doing good work. And you don't want to insult people, and you want to have a cooperative relationship with them. No, that's, but you're nice to them.
One of the things that that happened when I got on the board, not because I was on the board, but when I got on the board, and it was what Peter's initiative, noticed that much of the programming, very few minority groups got that money.
Mm-hmm.
Very few. And one of the initiatives Peter said was, that's going to change. And so we started soliciting, like, small programs. What was it? Linda Abernathy had a program. Remember that? So we took Best Interest of the Children. So we took that on. And then Boys and Girls had a program. But we started building a portfolio that had minority folks in there. So I'm just saying that to say we do direct what we end up funding. It's not just haphazard who walks through the door.
I would like to ask, when we even talk about priorities and funding and being relevant, I would like to ask Mark, John. I mean, what do you see do you feel like in your work are the priority areas still appropriate for us? I mean, you see so much, you're on a number of committees within the community and down with all of the providers, and so I guess what do you see or what would you like to see differently?
Well, and Lynn has spoken to this, but and actually I think different board members have as well, is that we have four broad categories, and within those four priorities, there are some specific, I guess, areas or services that we're particularly interested in, and in some cases we get a number of proposals that advance that priority in our investment. And one of the areas I think where we've seen a fair amount of change is in some of the areas that Tom was speaking about, and we have one of those programs sitting in the audience today is Dream House, in the investment in kind of prevention and early intervention. There's also a longstanding commitment, and the Access Initiative has been mentioned a number of times. That predates the increased focus on criminal justice. But that didn't mean that they were mutually exclusive or there wasn't some overlap there. But the Access Initiative for a period of time was very, very controversial. And yet today, the Community Coalition, which is an outgrowth of that, is very successful and well-regarded.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a credit to the Access Initiative and in the leadership that Peter provided. But that's also a longstanding commitment of the board, and I don't know that there are some specific services and activities that occur as a result of the investment in the development of system of care that come out of Access Initiative, and that in order to sustain that commitment, the board has to continue its investment because there really isn't other resources to put there. I think you can look at the question of an RFP or the field response, where you're putting out, you're refining, I suppose, within the four priorities or adding additional priorities, where you're refining what it is you're interested in. We had a proposal, a presentation recently about from Joel Saunders from Urbana Police Department about this one-door concept. I fully expect the board to receive a proposal in that regard. Mm-hmm. And that clearly falls under, I mean, it could fall under system of care. I would expect it, likely because of the law enforcement and the criminal justice involvement, to also possibly fall under behavioral health and criminal justice and behavioral health. But it's likely that we'll get a proposal there. And so we do have this chart, and I regret that there wasn't more detail provided about some of the historical of what comprises each, the allocations in each priority to give you some sense of how that shifted. But the board, and it's reflected in the total, you could, if we went back probably 3 years, you'd probably be under $3 million in terms of, in 2015, what the board was allocating. Mm-hmm. And again, Lynn's done quite a job in terms of shifting and reducing costs on the administrative side to increase what the board has been able to invest in the community. You could look at the multi-year contracts. Lynn raised that question internally already, and we kind of bounced it around, and it was kind of left, well, let's see what the board says.
Yeah.
But you can look at the growth we've had in our levy, and I don't know that there's much more savings that can be achieved internally within the administrative side of the budget, but you can look at the growth that we have in our levy, or the anticipated growth, and then look at, well, we have our existing commitments, and we expect this additional growth, and target the projected additional growth to new initiatives or additional priorities. But I mean, it's really the board's decision how you approach this. I'm listening.
Yeah.
And I think Lynn's listening, and Chandra and Stephanie are listening.
Go ahead. Could we also ask Chandra and Stephanie if they have a perspective?
Yes.
I'm sure they have a perspective.
I think this is so important because, I mean, you are the people who are working with all of these agencies and seeing the needs in the community. I mean, we see things from a different perspective based on our life. So, Chandra?
You get I need to know the question first.
The question is, questions are, do our priority areas remain relevant, and do you feel like the priority areas are still appropriate to our health board or to the mental health board's mission? Or how do you see it? What is there something that you see we need to be doing that we're not, that aren't included, or different ways? Thank you.
Yes. I do believe that the priorities are still relevant. What I also want to encourage you to do is not to box yourself in so tightly that you don't have room for the flexibility. I think that right now, the way that the priorities are set, there's you all have flexibility for innovative things. So keeping that innovation, the piece regarding
I think the priorities are that you have are still relevant. Like Mark's right, I think you are going to get a proposal from Joel Saunders, and that money's, if you decide to fund it, that money will have to, you know, come from somewhere, which may be shifting around other things, unless a big bucket gets dropped in our lap, which I don't anticipate, but... I think, and maybe it's just me because I kind of have tunnel vision when it comes to this, but I think there's a big suicide problem right now, not only nationally but locally, and probably that's going to come up and have to be addressed. And I'd look for that in the next year or two, definitely. That's all I have. Thank you.
Lynn. So that's actually on my list. I think we talked a lot last year and the year before about farmers and the despair in farming communities, but we also have made a lot of progress this year in moving out at least mental health first aid. Chandra has helped with that. There's a regional executive committee. We talk every month, and that's been the main topic, is how to get this training. So OSF, Carl, and the school districts, and then the mental health boards are involved in that. So I don't think we need to focus as much on that. We're also learning the population of our rural communities right here is changing. We may be looking at fewer young people and fewer people generally in the most sparsely populated areas of the county. However, there is a deep poverty in some of those. So we really do need to take some responsibility for, you know, how to get clusters of service to people who maybe don't have $5 to come to town. You know, so I think that's changed a little bit. But what I think the volume needs to come up on in these priorities is this is a really young community. And when we look at the CIT data, we can see that it's still something like 80% of the calls to CIT trained officers have something to do with suicide. And also a preponderance of those calls are coming from people who are associated with the U of I. So whether the U of I is not taking care of their business or not, doesn't matter. The cost is borne by this community. So something that Susan said earlier gives us a clue, and that is if you're co-funding programs that maybe the school should have done in the first place, you actually have some control over the way those services are being delivered. Same with the justice-involved set. If the sheriff was just contracting for all those, you would have nothing, you could say nothing about the content of the services. At least right now you have some say. And I think that's really important, especially as we see this great interest in trauma-informed care, and it's possibly not very specific, but there are really specific things that we're learning from trauma training that are really important. Like, you can't do social-emotional learning with little kids who have trauma. You can't do it. It adds to the trauma. So you have to do the trauma work first. So I think we've really funded a very robust set of early childhood programs between this board and the DD board, but now to sort of attend to like what we're doing there to really take that trauma-informed care to a new level, and that's maybe probably the most important thing that's going on in the system of care work too. There's just a tiny little bit of anti-violence or violence interruption. I wish we had more programs doing that, but we'd have to RFP for that. And I think the other thing we need to turn the volume up on is people who are really, really marginalized, like showing up, the people who are chronically without housing and showing up at, you know, maybe they're lucky to show up at the Phoenix. Maybe we should even be concerned about the people who aren't getting that far, like people who are very expensive to treat. And it can, sometimes you're spending more money for the first 14 months of their care than you will later. But you will eventually see the savings to other publicly funded systems like jails and hospitals and you know, just other public safety. So I think those are the really vulnerable people and youth. And I appreciate your comment about suicide, because I know you suggested it might be personal, but I think that's also really evident in the data. And that, you know, I don't mind minding the U of I's business for a minute if it helps us have a healthier community. And they're determined to grow the population of U of I by double. So we need to pay attention to what's going on with our streets and mental health. So Anyway.
Okay.
Thank you. Julian?
So I was about to talk about the one of the things you mentioned. I think the place that we're the most empty set is the seriously mentally ill, the people who are classical in whatever way colloquially you think about them and or clinically, seriously about them. We don't do much about that. And there's a reason, some of it is that it should be the state's responsibility, but the state doesn't take responsibility, but people still live here. So, and that interacts with, and there's the place to get a handle on it, which is a little different than it in the old days, where you could only get a hand. It's a little bit like the insight about trauma. You need to do different things than the classical models of treatment. It's also true that a way to get to the seriously mentally ill is to worry about concrete things like, do they have a place to live? And there's a lot of evidence that that makes a huge difference for people. Because, and you know, factually, the people with serious mental ill diagnoses have a very shortened lifespan. So it has huge health implications. So what I was about to say about that is that's an area, and I keep looking, when we funded the homeless services coordinator, I was asking then, and I'm going to keep asking, so what does that person do? What are they coordinating, and how are they coordinating it? And, you know, it seems to me there's a lot of potential there for doing important things, but that it might require an interagency, intergovernmental cooperation, including, I think, that, you know, the going and getting grants to help fund some of what they do, because there is, as I think, there's national money available for work in that area as well. And so what I'm saying is that is an area that I think we ought to think about targeting as something that's important. And if I recollect what Joel Sanders is talking about, if we were to take up that, there's a lot of already existing things that could be some of the money can come from bringing together that with some of the things that already exist and this problem, so which would expand its possibility for getting support. I think we have to think somewhat creatively about how to fund those things, and the way to do it is to do it. I mean, if we only do this and this. But I do think if we pay more attention to this, we can maybe have an impact on this community about things that are very difficult to deal with. Because, I mean, one thing I know for sure, having studied it my whole life, people with serious mental illness do not get cured. Sometimes they live okay. Sometimes they live pretty well. A lot of times they live terribly because they can't get resources. And they live better if communities make strong efforts to provide and keep available the supports that they need. So we could pay attention to that problem. But it wouldn't be the kind of answer that would say, well, see, if we just get more psychiatrists and they'll give them more medications and then everybody will get better, or if they just had more psychotherapy, that's not going to work, because it doesn't work.
If you don't have a place to live.
That works, it turns out. People are less troubled, and their emotional life is much better if they have a secure place to live. I mean, that's simple. It's not brilliant, but it's real.
I was thinking maybe there's years ago,
actually it was before I became a student, brought me to become a social worker is I worked in, I had an RFP for community support. So I was that person as people left. Of course, they were leaving facilities at that time. And I was that person in the community, and our community was Grinnell, Iowa at the time. And basically, that was the role, to help find housing, to help make sure that people got to appointments, group work, and working with families who were overwhelmed. And it was interesting. We moved from there, but the community went on, and utilizing RFPs had a great living facility for people. It was wonderful. It was access. It was downtown, so they could reach everything. It's still in existence now in Grinnell, but I wonder if there are RFPs for that, for community support, ongoing support, not just, you know, making sure somebody goes to a group, obviously, but for housing, the whole package. So that might be something we should look into, I would think. Tom?
I want to make a comment about Lynn's observation about this is a very young community, and that there are certain things that are going on that maybe should be dealt with by other institutions like the schools and U of I. So I'm thinking in my head, would we ever think about calling a meeting or conference or something with those groups to talk about this particular problem and how it impacts our community and what role that they play in it, and would they be willing to play a different role? The police might be wrong. The city of Champaign, if you guys are talking about housing and homelessness, here's what the city of Champaign does. If you're a felon, a landlord has the right to not rent to you until you've been out of prison for 5 years. You know what? After 5 years, 75% of the felons return to prison. So once you return to prison, then you're eligible to be for a landlord to rent to you. So we might have something to say about that problem. And if we met with people, maybe we could have some influence on the broader thing that we're wrestling with. Not going on, going at it by ourselves. I know the University of Illinois Counseling Center, which is small. I mean, it's the same size it was when the school was 35,000. Now it's 50,000. But they do have a suicide prevention program. But it is just for students. And you know who I think it probably works best for? Those kids who are on campus.
Yeah.
Your data shows that it's the students on campus that receive the services, but there's many suicides for off campus that aren't. Go ahead and talk about
that. I think, Mark, did you put that data into, or is that going in the October board packet, the CIT data? Yeah. I mean, it's the cities are responding to calls from U of I students and staff, and most of those calls are suicide threats and gestures and attempts. So, but the cities, yeah, you do have it, yes. I mean, it's just, we did talk about it at that CIT meeting. Julian brought it up, in fact.
Yeah, well, what you see is there's a very small percentage of the calls from the CIT calls is what we were looking at. Mm-hmm. Very small percentage involve the university police, and most of the issue, the time, it's the cities. And so I asked about that. Well, why isn't the university? And the answer from the point of view of the city police is, I think it was Joel, actually, who said, well, you know, they may go to maybe U of I students, but they're living in an apartment in Urbana. Yeah. So we get called. Yeah. I think that there's a good reason to ask the university to contribute to that problem.
I mean, I think about a month from now, I lost a student who was a former University of Illinois student, who was a student at Parkland. And one of the things that the University of Illinois doesn't let us know when they have students come to Parkland is to let us know something about mental health, because this student was registered in the class that I was teaching, and I did not even know that there was an issue until the morning that I got a call that, hey, before you go to class, this is what has happened. One of your students completed suicide. So I think the University of Illinois has a role to play within the larger community, not just being a research-one university. There is more to play within this community to make it part of it. Well, I've had my microphone on for a while, but I mean, I think I look around and I see Dream House. Dream House came as a result of, did you see that there was a need in the community and you filled it? And, or did you just know that this was something that we all could do? I'm putting it to you because you're the only one here, and we're talking about innovative and what makes things happen. Because the first year, I don't think we funded.
No, we didn't.
So, if you want to come up to the microphone or you want to say something, please. I mean, because it would help us. Microphone over there.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you. It was definitely recognizing and kind of living with the need in some ways. So I worked at the Boys and Girls Club, done some work with the Juvenile Detention Center with peer ambassadors for a number of years. Then I taught at Parkland for some years, and I just recognized that I saw this common theme among particularly African-American males around social-emotional deficiencies, lack of academic preparedness, and so thinking, wow, what can we do from an early intervention standpoint to make sure that our boys and our young men are just much more prepared for life success? And so it was definitely, you know, an experience of being in community that showed me what we can do to help transform the community with some more early intervention and prevention approaches.
So, I mean, I think, part of what I hear you say is that being a part of a community and seeing that there is a need within the community, and there are other needs also, but you've created that niche for yourself. I mean, looking at suicide as, I mean, I also have a personal story about suicide beyond my students who have completed suicide. What do we need to do as a larger community? I mean, you have your niche, but do you have any ideas of how we as a larger community can create, I mean, we know that there is a need, but how do you create the opportunity like you did for us?
Well, I think there are a lot of people out there eager to do some work, particularly around girls. I think when GAP left our service array, that left a gap in our services. And so we see a lot of delinquency among, and also social-emotional challenges even among young girls in our schools and community. And then as they get older, that begins to play out in different ways, right? And that also is embedded in the trauma experiences that many people in our community grapple with. So I know girl delinquency is another issue that we need to think about. I often get the question, what about girls? You know, how can we create something similar to Dream House for girls? How can we get them on a pathway or a pipeline of hope so that they can get the support early so as they become young ladies, they are more prepared for life and more prepared for becoming a healthy adult? I also agree with the issue around the serious mentally ill in the community. It's another area that I see it when I go into the terminal. You know, they are not supported. They have nowhere to go. They are just on the streets and in our public places. And we need to think about how can we provide some services for those individuals. And one last, and not to take up any of your meeting, but another area of, I think, desperate need is that 18 to 25, 26 population. They are struggling in so many life domain areas. They are not prepared for work. They do not have good behavioral health. They are dealing with trauma. They are having children and not being able to fully practice good parenting skill with the kids that they are, you know, bringing into this world. And so they are another area, another target population that really needs some serious intensive supports so that we can hopefully derail some of their future life challenges that they may face as they get older. And we definitely want to do anything that we can do to decrease incarceration among our people in the community.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
so much. See, and I think that's asking, you're in the midst, and so it's so helpful to see from your perspective the need, and really appreciate your comments.
Well,
and hope you can find
here.
Somebody to, I know that everybody's probably wanting you to start the girl thing.
They do.
It's not like you don't have enough going on. But to think about that as a proposal, maybe you do know someone who could do that, who could bring that as a proposal
mm-hmm.
next year.
Definitely.
And obviously, maybe we'll, won't wait a year to fund them like we did you. No. Just kidding.
All right.
Thank you so
Appreciate
much.
It.
So I think we need to, I was trying to think of how I'm going to summarize this, but I think I'm going to ask Lynn to summarize comments. And I think as we move forward, obviously we're not going to solve everything tonight, but to be thinking about different areas that we could work on. And it was really a great conversation, and thank you. And thank you to the staff, because we know how hard you work. We know, and appreciate that. So, and thanks to everybody here, because there's a lot of issues that we need to work on. And I think we're moving forward, which is encouraging. So, thanks.
Yeah, one last comment. Lynn's brought it up, and Lynn brings it up often. But I think that retention is something that we need to focus a lot more on as far as staff retention and recruitment. We see every year money that we get back, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the main reason, if not the exclusive reason, is that they could not hire people to fill the positions. There's money in this community right now that we can't spend on people because we don't have a staff person. Mark was at the Continuum of Care meeting with me this month, where Lisa Benson from RPC was explaining about how they have maybe about a dozen or so shelter plus care vouchers, which are subsidized housing vouchers that are paired with intensive case management. And the requirement is there has to be a case manager, and they cannot fill probably about a dozen of these vouchers because there's not an agency that has available case managers. And I see the one thing I think that we could do that is specific is to put more of a focus on that. The way we do with stigma, I think it's great because I think that is a huge aspect of why mental health is so pervasive and untreated is stigma. And so we've recognized that as an issue and we spend money on that. And I think that we should start thinking of innovative ways to, whether it's recruitment, whether it's scholarships, whether it's identifying people who are only bachelor's levels but are working in the field and giving scholarships for them to, you know, upgrade to MSW or whatever it may be. Maybe it's reaching out to high schoolers who have no idea what they want to do in life. You know, I feel like social workers aren't really a household name the way a school teacher, you know, people that want to help are usually, oh, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a teacher, I want to be a police officer, firefighter, but do little kids say, I want to be a social worker, you know, think of ways to make it more of in our culture, but That's just kind of my final thought. I think that we should think of ways to approach that.
I want to say something that's very interesting on that is my brother-in-law's involved with a large non-for-profit. Actually, what's really interesting is in Rockford, Illinois. Of course, then I'm trying to think of it. But they actually are money-wise are in a really good place, which doesn't usually happen with nonprofits. But they do help pay tuition. They pay off student loans. So they have a great rate of keeping their social workers for a longer length of time because, and I know the federal government does that in different agencies, but that's huge because you're pretty much guaranteed the person will stay there 3 years. And social workers really don't make very much money. If you look at the salary, I mean, I think you can make more being a checker at Sam's Club than you can as a social worker. And so you look at that, if somebody's going to, I mean, that's really like $18 an hour. That's so that's really something that's helped their agency in keeping young graduates there. Because you get a lot of people here in our area who are from U of I. They get a job where they interned, and then, so that's something to think about.
Could I ask a question about that? What's the... There's a specific agency that you are thinking of that doesn't have them. Yeah, I was trying to figure out.
All of them. I mean, it's really, it's.
So what we're saying is the whole community, there's not enough people available for case management in order to get people the living, vouchers that are available.
That was one anecdote that happened this month. I think if you ask Lynn or Mark, somebody who's got more in depth, that there'll be dozens. I mean,
can I give you one?
We just bought our Scylla houses because we had such a surplus, and that surplus is almost, primarily because they can, agencies can't staff.
Yeah. So they can't fill it. Staff it.
And there's money there, it's like there's money in our community that cannot be spent.
So my son has had 5 case managers and 7 or case managers in 7 years because of turnover. Continuity of care is always an issue.
So my question, just to understand this before we stop, I know we want to stop, but I think there's something important in this. Is the problem that the positions don't pay enough, or is it that the work is so hard that people burn out?
And you want to fix something, or you really want to make it better for so many people, and you struggle, and you don't. That is part of it. Part of it is, I think, for a lot of the younger people coming out of school, it's economics because you can make more money in an agency, and if you have to pay back your student loans, but part.
$35,000 is the average salary I noticed in our agency
for social workers. And you think about, I know a number of them who have left, and now they work for. They'll go to Chicago because they do pay higher there. Of course, cost of living is higher. And also it is burnout. And I loved being a social worker, but I will tell you there were probably, when I was in the schools, there were probably 15 years of my life where I did not sleep. Because I would wake,
So there's different strategies for dealing with those two aspects of the problem.
Yeah.
And they're not mutually exclusive. I never thought about taking it on directly, but there are strategies for raising funds from the private sector to support activities like this, but it requires some, systematic development. A lot of work gets done through
well-off people, or even just moderately well-off people who want to be charitable. And but it does require a systematic raising of funds. So that's part of it. What I'm saying is, what the money that's available can be supplemented. It does take systematic. But the other part, the burnout part, is something that I've often thought about, which is because those folks are often left to, they're just singly operating, and there's no systematic way, community of support for them, with one another, with training, and there's all kinds of programmatic ways that could be developed to help support the daily work. Some of which means, you know, you have enough people doing it so that you don't have to work so many hours, but also the social support and, you know, the creation of a community of people doing this work. So
and I will say, personally, I had this social support network. I know Joe did, but it's just like you can't, I think that's the reality. I can't fix this.
We have to change, kind of almost like we will have to change how society thinks about work and how we really, because we still are very individualistic. We don't have this collectivist idea. And so until we get a little bit more community, really, when we talk community, really be community, we'll have a lot more burnout. 22-year-olds or 23-year-olds come right out of college having to deal with some severely mentally ill folks, just have a really rough time, and they don't have anybody to go back to. We don't have really good supervision at many of these agencies, and so we're looking, it's a much bigger thing that it's not just about the money, it's about also creating a larger community in which these folks thrive so that they can keep doing what they're doing.
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
It isn't always about money.
$35,000 starting, and you owe it's $35,000 a year now, probably. So, but anyway, I think this is go ahead.
Because I think that burnout has always been there, but it didn't matter as much until we hit this shortage. So, we've got one project that we've done for about a year, which is to bring case managers together. The attraction is you need CEUs anyway, so we're going to offer some for free in town, so lower the cost to the agency. But the real idea was to develop a community. So a little bit of what you were talking about is like seeded, and maybe we could take some time to develop some other pieces of an initiative like what you said, but I think that might be separate from this priorities document, you know, the funding priorities for agencies. Like, this is a big project that we could do, and we could do it, we could start working on it tomorrow and just develop some materials for y'all to consider around these issues. So I think that's one thing. The second thing is for your next study session, if this format is okay, that I know it's the end of October, but if this approach is all right, we can just develop similar materials, and then you have whatever discussion you want to have. Or do you not want to see all these, that made your stomach lurch?
Well, it's just that I
have them. Yeah. Okay, so in addition to the two priority categories broken out like that as background for whatever you choose to talk about, there are actually two very substantial consent decrees in the state of Illinois, one related to each of your next priorities. So I'm trying to find just real brief fact sheets to include. One is new, and that's the NB versus Norwood, and that's regarding the state's failure to do, early periodic detection screening treatment. So that's, the state is now compelled by the federal government to get it together for young children who have behavioral health concerns. What? So you have very significant investments in the area right now under the system of care priority. So this means the state needs to start paying for some of that. But again, if you want... Yeah, right. And then the other is that... Well, the state needs to start paying for some of that, and so that might change what you can pay for in there. You know, if some of it's if it's covered under Medicaid, then people need to bill it to Medicaid. That's what's coming down to. And the same is true with the Liggett's consent decree. That's related to developmental disabilities. It's the same thing. So just like a fact sheet on what those obligations of the state are, whether they ever meet them or not. And so, you know, this is just like, it's just dry. Well, 2 years since the court ruling, they still don't have an approved implementation plan, which is why I've had a hard time. Mark has been helping me finding a brief fact sheet since nothing.